that this body we cherish so much is just a pile of organic stuff. That is constantly in the process of decaying, of aging. And one day it will cease altogether. Mind stream will leave it. And this thing that we're sitting in right now on the meditation cushion will one day become a corpse, laid out somewhere, depending on the circumstances of our death. Some people may come look at it, some people may not. But regardless, it will either be tossed in the earth or tossed in the fire or, depending on the circumstances of our death, may be lost in the water. And when the mind separates from this body and the body becomes a corpse, our precious human life has ended. This rare opportunity we have to encounter the Dharma, to meet the teachers and teachings, to have the time and wherewithal to practice, all that will be over and irretrievable. Everything we've collected in this life stays here. And even if we think that we might have a good reputation after we die, or that many people will miss us and cry because we're not here, all these people too will perish. And in fact, someday this whole planet will perish. That's its very nature. It's impermanent. The only thing that comes with us is the karmic imprints and our mental habits. Everything else that we've spent our whole life getting, creating, doing, having, being, stays here. And simply the mere eye labeled independent upon the continuum of consciousness goes on. But that mere eye experiences happiness and suffering. That mere eye has the potential to become a Buddha, or it can continue cycling in samsara for many more eons. It's all up to us. We're the ones who choose how to use our time and energy. So it's important to think about what is valuable in life. And from the perspective of the great Buddhist masters and the Buddha himself, the most valuable things are bodhicitta and the wisdom realizing reality. So the more we can learn about, contemplate, meditate on these, the more we can plant the seeds in our mind of understanding them, the more we're creating the cause for happiness for ourselves and others. Because those seeds of our Dharma understanding, the good karma we create, that goes on into our future lives. And so especially that extraordinary, very noble motivation of bodhicitta. That motivation through which we can make everything we do valuable, make everything we do part of the path to enlightenment. That motivation which enables us to create so much positive karma quickly, and which acts as the force to penetrate the nature of reality and become Buddhas. That bodhicitta is very important for us to familiarize ourselves with again and again. And so once again, let's generate that altruistic intention to become a Buddha for the benefit of each and every sentient being. So, as the Buddha kept reminding us, our motivation is the most important thing. Yeah. Not what we do, but why we do it. And so for that reason, we keep on coming back to look at our motivation. And we keep coming back to again and again generate bodhicitta. So even though we may not have spontaneous bodhicitta right now, somehow by the force of familiarity of again and again thinking about the welfare of sentient beings, their suffering, their kindness to us, by again and again thinking about that, again and again generating bodhicitta, then slowly that mind will become automatic and spontaneous in us. that just as with anything we have to, you know, that requires habituation, we have to habituate ourselves with it. It's like learning to read. We had to practice reading a long time, right? And learning our times tables, you have to practice a long time, and it becomes spontaneous. Or learning to type, you know, practice, practice, practice. So same thing here with our motivation, again and again and again, coming back to this motivation. And the more we do, the more it really permeates our entire life, so that we can live with bodhicitta, or even a facsimile of it, or even just love and compassion, or even just nonviolence and non-harmfulness. All of those are good, you know. And when we have that motivation, then it's like in Zopa Rinpoche's prayer, what he wrote, you know, it doesn't matter if we're in good circumstances or bad circumstances. Doesn't matter if people like us or they hate us. Doesn't matter if our body's in pleasure or in pain. If we're living, if we're dying, if we get what we want or we don't get what we want. Okay, if people appreciate us or scorn us. None of that matters beans when the mind has bodhicitta. Why? Because the bodhicitta mind is focused on something so extraordinary and so noble, and it has its priorities so clear, yeah. So that realizing the nature of reality and benefiting sentient beings are the two, you know, most important things. So, you know, they serve what I like for breakfast. Who cares? You know, it's like it's gone in 15 minutes, whether you like it or don't like it, you know. Somebody praises us, somebody criticizes us, you know, they like our clothes, they don't like our clothes. We look in the mirror and we like what we see, we look in the mirror, we don't like what we see. None of it matters, you know, because the life, the mind is directed towards something so vast and so valuable that we know is possible, and we know we can get there. So then our life has a whole different meaning, a whole different feel about it. And it's extraordinary how when we turn our mind to benefiting others, we become happier ourselves. Because you know, when you have bodhicitta in the mind, then all these usual unhappinesses that we experience, we don't care about it. Yeah? And when you have bodhicitta, you direct it towards enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Then you get material things and money, or you don't have them. Eh. People approve of you, they praise you, they love you, or they don't, and they blame you, and they criticize you, and talk about you behind your back. Eh. You have a good reputation and receive honors and awards, and or you have a bad reputation and everybody trashes you behind your back. Yeah. You know, you see nice things, hear nice music, have good food, you know, your body's always comfortable, or your body's racking in pain. Yeah. You don't care, you know, because you see these things are completely trivial, you know, totally 100%. Stupid, yeah, because they're just revolving around me and my happiness, and they have nothing to do with, you know, the welfare of all sentient beings. They're just, you know, self-pity, me sniffing, I want my pleasure, and that self-pity, self-centered mind causes us so much misery. You know, when we're focused on the welfare of others, then we experience so much joy because the self-centered mind isn't there doing its song and dance show. Yeah. We probably all had a good look at our self-centered mind this week. Yeah? Has any of that come up in your meditation? now, and the whole, we write all these scenarios, all these dramatic screenplays of, oh, how terrible I am and how terrible my life is, all my problems and everything I have to worry about. And then we just get more and more upset about it, more and more fearful about the future, more and more anxious about what's going to happen. And we experience so much suffering. Right? You know why? Because there's no bodhicitta in the heart. When we are able to generate that compassion that cherishes others, our own melodramas get put into perspective, you know, and they become so insignificant. I mean, I had this years ago, this incredible, horrible thing. You can't believe what these people did to me. Absolutely disgraceful. Horrendous. You can't believe. And there were a bunch of Buddhists, and some of them were even Buddhist teachers. I mean, the guts. I just And then what they did was so unfair. It was so, I mean, they caused me headaches, blah, blah, blah. I mean, you can't believe when a book didn't get published because of it, and they were talking behind my back, and I was like trying so nice, using all my conflict mediation skills to bring a remedy to it, and all they did was keep trashing me, and I was just totally miserable, you know, because it was so unfair, right? And I was miserable on this continent because this thing was going on for months and months and months and months, you know. And I was miserable here, and I went to Dharamsala for His Holiness's spring teachings, and I was miserable there, and I complained about it to people here, and I got to India and I complained about it to people there. And my friend Alex says, as he usually does, "This is samsara, what do you expect?" And I said, "I expect better than this." What these people are doing is awful. And I just sat and stewed for months. I was miserable about this. And then one day, you know, I was walking back after His Holiness's spring teachings. I was walking back to my room. And the thought occurred in my mind. I don't know how this thought ever came in my mind. But it came in my mind that there were over 5 billion human beings on this planet, and I don't know how many gazillion insects. And that was just this planet. And no one else was upset about this difficulty that except me. That this whole horrible situation that was a national disaster, I was the only one upset by it. So that made me pause a minute and think that maybe I was caring about the wrong things. Because if this problem was not a big deal to everybody else on this planet, then maybe the world wasn't going to fall apart because of it. And maybe, just maybe, there are some more important things to think about. And maybe I was causing my own misery. So like I said, I don't know how that thought came in my mind that I was the only person worried about this, but somehow it did, you know, these weird thoughts that make you question yourself. Okay? So there's something about seeing the disadvantages of self-centeredness and seeing the advantages of compassion and bodhicitta that brings so much joy, not only to everybody else, but in our own little bitty, itty, bitty heart. Yeah? That lets our own heart relax and open. Okay, so this is the bodhicitta that we want to live with, because we want to die with it, and we die the way we live. Okay? If we live with self-pity, we die with self-pity. If we live with anger and resentment, good chance we're going to die with anger and resentment. And then, you know, these become the mind states that make various karmas ripen, and the mind states that, you know, are prominent in our next rebirth. Have you ever noticed that when you go to sleep at night, the state of your mind influences how you wake up in the morning? Have you ever noticed that? That if you go to sleep and you're really upset or anxious, almost the first thought when you wake up in the morning is being upset and anxious. You notice that? So, you know, even though 8 hours or 10 hours or however much, you know, we've indulged in has gone by, that first thought in the morning is similar to the last thought at night. Now this happens also as we go from one life to the next life. Yeah? What we're thinking about is how we set the stage. What we're thinking about the time of death is how we set the stage for the intermediate stage and for our next rebirth. And so just as every morning we try and generate our motivation, remember, as much as possible, I'm going to help others, I'm not going to harm them, and I'm going to have this bodhicitta mind and live according to it today. Just as we deliberately generate that every morning, just in case we forgot about it at night before we went to bed, and even if we didn't forget about it, we still generate it again to familiarize ourselves and make it stronger in our mind. Then similarly, at the time of death, if we can bring this bodhicitta mind, to whatever extent we have it, up to the forefront, then there's a good chance that it will be the thing that makes the karma ripen, and so we'll have good karma ripening at the time of death, instead of hell being karma ripening because we're angry. And then as we go in and make the transition into our next life, you know, maybe we'll enter next life with a little bit of bodhicitta in the mind, you know? With a little bit of kindness, a little bit of graciousness and appreciation and trust in our mind. Yeah? So I think, especially for those of us who have difficulties with trust, who have trust issues, bodhicitta is very good. How many of you have difficulty trusting? Yeah. Trust is a hard thing, isn't it? Yeah. We trust and then somebody turns around and acts like a bozo and hurts us. And it's all their fault. Isn't it? This is my Spanish vocabulary I learned in Mexico. The bozo is a very good word, isn't it? To describe it. And, you know, we feel when our feelings are hurt, like, wow, you know, what did I do? I was acting in good trust. I was, you know, just being sweet and cooperative and, you know, trying to be kind to this other person and fulfill my responsibilities, and then out of the blue they turn around and do this. You know, can you believe it? They turn around and throw mud in my face. Yeah. After how kind I was to them, how much I trusted them, how much they were part of my life, how much I admired them, you know, how much commitment we had towards each other, they turn around and they throw mud in my face. And then we think, okay, that's it for sentient beings. You know, totally unreliable, totally untrustworthy, throw up my defenses, you know, and don't trust them. Don't open my heart to them. Navigate, go through life navigating my way around them, using them when they're to my benefit, avoiding them when they're threatening, and that way I won't get hurt again. So we throw up the roadblocks and we go through life like this, and we're miserable. Now the thing about that mind, that is, there's a certain element that is true of it, but the way we relate to that element is unhealthy. Okay? The element of that mind that's true is that sentient beings are sentient beings, and we can't expect them to be perfect. And sentient beings are sentient beings, and we can expect whatever we want from them, but that doesn't mean that they're going to deliver. Why? Because they're under the influence of ignorance, anger, and attachment, just like me. And through our meditation practice, sometimes we come to see how unappreciative we are of others' kindness. Yeah. Once in a while that thought sneaks in the mind. Maybe we don't appreciate others enough, and that they have been kinder to us than we've acknowledged. So other sentient beings are likewise with that mind. Yeah. Self-centered mind, just like us. Yeah. So no wonder they do things that break trust, because they're confused, they're in pain, they don't see things clearly, just like us. So expecting them to be Buddhas, taking refuge in them, and expecting them to always be there for us, no matter what, that's a little bit unrealistic from our side, isn't it? Yeah? A little bit unrealistic. Okay, so that part of that cynical defensive mind that says, you know, sentient beings have limitations, that part's correct. But what's not correct in the cynical, walled-up defensive mind is, now I've got to protect myself from them. Because when we have that defensiveness, we haven't yet relinquished the expectations. We're still expecting sentient beings to change and come through for us. And we're just being very defensive because we know they won't, but we're still expecting them to. And so we're not really having love and compassion for them. We're accepting them for what they are. And so we get very defensive because we're still expecting them to be Buddhas and to always be there for us, which is impossible. Whereas with the mind of bodhicitta, with the mind of compassion, we see, yes, sentient beings are limited. But they're not limited because they're evil and bad and horrible. They're limited because they're overpowered by their afflictions. They're overpowered by their self-centered mind, by their ignorance, anger, and attachment. And what a tragedy that is. Here, all these sentient beings who've been so kind to me, upon whom which my life depends, who have the potential to become fully enlightened Buddhas, and here they are, under the influence, trapped, enveloped in the darkness of their ignorance. Yeah, bound by the strong chains of karma, which are so hard to undo. And so then, instead of feeling resentful towards them and holding on to our unrealistic expectations, instead the heart fills with compassion. Yeah? And when our heart has compassion for sentient beings like this, then we become more trusting, but we have more wisdom with our trust. So instead of our trust being blind and filled with all sorts of unrealistic expectations, and instead of our trust being very demanding, you must do this, instead the trust is just an appreciation of what they do, focusing on what sentient beings do for us, not on what they don't do. And when we focus on all the kindness that they do give us, we see, wow, that there is a lot to trust in them. I mean, we're alive now. Doesn't that indicate that something, we're alive and our whole life is dependent upon the kindness of other sentient beings who have kept us alive since we were born? Doesn't that indicate some kindness on their part and some ability for us to trust them? Because we haven't been the ones who have kept ourselves alive this whole time. We haven't grown our own food. We haven't made our own clothing. We didn't change our own diapers. We didn't come into this life with money. We came into this life stark naked with nothing. And look how much we have now. So much that you have to come here to and have me encourage you to give it away, to clean it out. You know, houses full of stuff, cars full of stuff, closets full of stuff. We came into this life with a zip, and it was all given to us, wasn't it? It was all given to us by the kindness of others. Okay? So we're not the ones who, you know, kept ourselves alive. We didn't educate ourselves. Other people taught us. Other people encouraged us. Think of all the people in your life who taught you things. You know, just to read, to speak, to tie your shoes. You know, the kindness of the people who potty trained us. Thank goodness for them. You know? I mean, just think about it. How much kindness we've received our entire lives. So we can trust sentient beings. But we have to be wise in how we trust them. And not expect them to be Buddhas. And understand that they are limited in the same way we are limited. I had this extraordinary experience in 1994 when I did a tour of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet republics, Dharma tour teaching. I went to, oh, I don't know how many places. Forgot, it was either 10 or 15 places, you know, in a period of about 6 weeks. And I would arrive in most of the tour I did by train, and most of it I was traveling alone. For part of it, one friend was with me. But most of the time I was alone, and I would get off the train in a country where I didn't speak the language and often didn't even read the alphabet, because I had forgotten all the Russian I studied in college. We'd get off the train. I had no money of that country, didn't speak the language, got off in the train station and stood on the platform, and every single time a total stranger came up, greeted me, took me home and fed me. Yeah? I mean, the people knew beforehand I was coming, you know, so they knew what train to meet. Yeah? But they always showed up. They always showed up. And these total strangers took me home and fed me and welcomed me in their homes. And I gave some Dharma teachings. And before I got on the next train, they would pile me with food. And most of them had very little, very, very little. This was the site of my Kashmir sweater. So, you know, it's really kind of amazing how sentient beings just come through for you. Yeah? Yeah? We get on a plane and a total stranger takes us somewhere. Yeah. And we trust them with our life. And they come through for us so far. We're here.
Yeah.
So, you know, this process of really seeing the kindness of others and opening our hearts to it, letting go of the self-centered mind, and developing this long-term bodhicitta motivation is something quite important for our own happiness right now, as well as for our spiritual progress. Okay, so yesterday we were talking about the 5 points to practice at the time of death, right? So this bodhicitta mind is the principal thing that we want to practice when we're alive, so that it can be the principal thing we practice at the time we die. Okay? So it's not that we just talk about bodhicitta, blah, 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 and it's nice, but then we get back to being resentful. We really try and transform our own minds so we can live and die with this bodhicitta. So we talked about the first of the 5 forces at death, the white seed, which meant giving everything away and simplifying and starting to do that now. We talked about the second one, the prayers of aspiration. So that's you know, the 7-limb prayer, and really transforming our mind into those 7 wonderful thoughts. What also comes in the prayers of aspiration is making offerings to our spiritual mentor, making offerings to the 3 jewels, because the 3 jewels and our spiritual mentor are some of the strongest objects of karma that we have. Because of the role they play in our life, guiding us spiritually. Our parents are strong objects of karma because of their kindness. The poor and the sick are strong objects of karma because of their need. But especially at the time of death, we want to really be able to hold the 3 jewels and our spiritual mentor in our mind and in our heart. Because by remembering them, then we cause virtuous karma to ripen at the time of death. Because when we think of our teacher and when we think of the 3 jewels, we should be thinking of the Dharma. Okay? So we should be thinking of bodhicitta and emptiness. If you think of your spiritual teacher and you're thinking of a personality, or you're thinking about how they scolded you, or about how they didn't say what you wanted them to say, then you need to go back in the long run about properly relying on a spiritual mentor so that you change your mind, so that, you know, when you think of your spiritual mentor, you think about the Dharma. Because at the time of death, that's going to be real, real important. And so that's why somebody mentioned having a picture of their spiritual mentor and the Buddha, you know, at their bedside. I think that's quite good. And when we're sick, when we're dying, you know, unless you're like Rupa Rinpoche that I told you about, who had the appearance of Buddhas in his hospital room, unless we're like that, it's good to have some kind of picture, and it reminds us of their qualities. Okay, and then we do aspirational prayers, and we pray to never be separated from the 3 jewels. We pray never to be separated from the bodhicitta. We pray never to be separated from the wisdom realizing emptiness. We pray never to be separated from the kind Mahayana guru who can teach these things to us. Okay, so that's very, very important, you know, because that really sets the stage for the kind of rebirth we have. You know, whether we're born here, whether we're born there, that's not so important, you know, but that we're never separated from the 3 jewels and a qualified spiritual mentor, that's important. That we're never separated from the bodhicitta and the wisdom realizing emptiness, and the teachings on them, That's important. Okay, so we really make strong aspirational prayers in that direction. Okay, then the third of the five forces is the force of destruction. So what are we destroying? Our old friend, the self-centered mind. Okay? Our old friend, the self-grasping ignorance. These two demons that have plagued us since beginningless time. I once gave a talk in a classroom at a public school in Woodinville, and some kid, this was a high school, came up to me afterwards, and he was clearly from a fundamentalist family, and he asked me if Buddhists believed in the devil. And I said, not in an external devil, but for us, the biggest devils are our self-centeredness. That's the biggest devil. Yeah, no need to be afraid of anybody or anything outside. I mean, the worst any external being can do is kill us. That's all. It's the worst they can do. They can't send us to the lower realms. They can't cause us a bad rebirth. The worst they can do is kill us. Okay? But our self-centered thought, the self-grasping ignorance, that can cause us a lower rebirth. That can bring us suffering for eons upon eons upon eons. Okay. So that's the big demon. Those two are the big demon, the big devils. So that's what we want to destroy. So what we want to do is be able to identify them and counteract them. We counteract the self-grasping ignorance by meditating on emptiness. We counteract the self-centered thought by meditating on compassion and bodhicitta. Okay, and so at this time in the dying process, it's very helpful to remind ourselves that we don't need to grasp at our body and mind. Okay? That there's nothing in this body worth grasping at, worth being attached to. There's nothing in our mind worth grasping at. We don't need to hold these things as inherently existent. We don't need to cling on to them. We don't need to hold on to our personality, to this whole ego structure that we've built up that makes us think we know who we are in this world. We don't need to hold on to any of it. We can let the whole kit and caboodle go. And just trust. Just trust in the bodhicitta. Trust in the three jewels. You know. We don't need to grasp at our body, our personality, our possessions, or anything when we're dying. And nor do we need to grasp at them when we're alive, but especially when we're dying. And so also at this point, we make a very strong determination not to let our mind go under their influence. Okay, so strong determination. If you're a person inclined towards anger, very strong determination. I am not going to let my mind be filled with anger and resentment, you know, as I go through the dying process. If you're inclined towards self-pity, strong determination, I am not going to let my mind go under the influence of self-pity. Okay? So whatever your thing is, if you're strongly inclined towards attachment, I am not going to let my mind cling on to stuff. Because there's nothing here worthwhile clinging to. Okay, so you make those strong determinations, and then you also do Vajrasattva practice. And so you purify the karma you created under those attitudes. You think that you're also purifying those disturbing attitudes and negative emotions. Okay. So when you're dying, when you're doing Vajrasattva practice, you don't have to sit up in a meditation position, you know, and that whole thing. And when you're sick, similarly, I mean, you can lie in bed. Doesn't matter. You can still visualize Vajrasattva above your head and do the mantra and have the light and nectar pour into you. Okay? So don't think when you're sick and dying that, oh, I can't practice because I can't sit in front of my shrine on a meditation cushion in meditation position. You know, Dharma practice is what you do with your mind, so you use your mind wherever you are. You know? And you think of those people trapped in an earthquake. You know, you're in an earthquake and you're trapped in some rubble. Doesn't matter. Vajrasattva's on your head and you can say the mantra. You can still meditate. Okay? So it doesn't matter, you know, what's going on in our life or where we are. We just practice right then and there. Okay? Then the fourth of the 5 points is motivation. Okay? So our old friend motivation. So we cultivate bodhicitta very strongly, and then we make a very strong determination. You know, to meditate on emptiness as we're dying, or if you have had instruction and you've done this highest yoga tantra practice of transforming death, bardo, and rebirth into the three kayas, then you make a strong intention to do that practice. Or if you don't do that practice, you just make a strong intention to have bodhicitta as you're dying in the bardo, the intermediate stage, and in your next rebirth. Yeah, just strong motivation, strong intention. And I'm working for the benefit of sentient beings. You know, as long as I live, I'm living for their benefit. When I die, I'm dying for their benefit. When I get reborn, may I be reborn for their benefit. There's the story of one Tibetan master who, you know, very excellent practitioner, but when he was dying, he was weeping. And his disciples came up and said, "Master, why are you weeping? You know, you've practiced so well during your life." And he said, "I've been praying to be reborn in the hell realms to benefit sentient beings, but instead I'm having the vision of a pure land that I'm going to be reborn there." And his real wish was to be born in the hell realms to benefit the sentient beings there. So he was weeping because his wish wasn't happening. Okay? So, you know, to have that strong motivation just to be able to die, go into the bardo, and be reborn all for the benefit of sentient beings. Wherever that takes us, doesn't matter. Okay, then the fifth one is the power of acquaintance, or the power of familiarity. And so this is calling to mind the practices that we've acquainted ourselves and familiarized ourselves with during our life. Okay, what are these practices? Okay, meditation on emptiness. Yeah, checking where the eye is. The taking and giving meditation, which is part of the bodhicitta sequence. Taking on the suffering of others, giving them our happiness. Okay. So you lie in the lion position. This is the position that the Buddha passed away in. They advise us to go to sleep in this position at night if we can. On our right side, with our right hand under our cheek, if we can block, use the ring finger to block the nostril, that's good. If you can't, that's okay. And the left hand on our side. You know, be in that position if you can. And relax. Have absolutely no expectation. And just do the taking and giving meditation. If you have any kind of weird appearances to your mind, just recall that all they are appearances. They're not inherently existent. Yeah? Don't get involved in them. They're just appearances to the mind. Yeah? Fix your mind on the Buddha or your meditation deity. Fix your mind on emptiness, dependent arising. Fix your mind on bodhicitta, refuge. Whatever works for you, do it. And then just go on. Okay, so to prepare ourselves to die like this, we have to practice very well in our life. And so those moments when we're taken by surprise with something, you know, to check up, like my friend when he slipped on the vegetables in the Dharamsala marketplace, check up what your first thought is and train your mind, you know, to make it a virtuous one. And then just really relax, you know, as much as possible while we're alive. Don't create negative karma. Purify any negative karma that we've taken. Do, you know, engage in positive actions. Take precepts. And practice. Be generous. Be kind. So that's it. Okay. Just sit quietly for a couple of minutes.